Welcome to another episode of the Maine Humanities Council's Humanities on Demand podcast series. Here we join Charles Calhoun, independent scholar for the Maine Humanities Council and author of the biography Longfellow, A Rediscovered Life. This talk on great books was recorded at an event held on July 21st, 2014 at the Thornton Oaks Retirement Community in Brunswick, Maine.
Good afternoon to you all. It's very nice to be here. I want to do three things today in this talk. One is to examine this phenomenon of the great books and why some people read them and some people don't read them, and some people think they ought to read them but never get around to it, and some people feel guilty about that and some don't, but there you are. Then I want to talk about the Maine Humanities Council's Winter Weekend in particular, tell you a little bit about that if you haven't been. And then I want to end with an example that I found in the recent edition of the New York Times, a sample of how these great books are still alive and working and causing controversy even in the culture that we live in today. So let me just start with a small reminiscence. When you were growing up, did you have in your house a set of President Eliot's 5-foot shelf of books? Yes. And if you didn't have one at home, your local library probably had a set. And if they didn't, probably the local bookstore, the secondhand bookstore, had a set up on the top shelf gathering dust. It was an American phenomenon that was found throughout American culture. And it was a very important symbol for a lot of people of a certain approach to learning and to even character building. These weren't just books. These weren't just classic texts that had been read and reread. They were intended as a way of understanding life and of structuring a personality and of building character and of improving the country and all that. And they were the work of a Harvard professor named Charles Eliot. I'm going to talk about him in just a moment. But in my own life, if I can reminisce a little bit for a moment, that set of books played an interesting role. I was an undergraduate at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, and I'm somewhat ashamed to admit I was a very active member of a social fraternity there, Kappa Sigma. And in the so-called library of the Kappa Sigma House, a very ambitiously named room, it was one of the party rooms, really, on the ground floor of the house, there was a very nice set of bookcases. It was a colonial revival building. And some alumnus in the past had quite optimistically given a set of the great books, the 5-foot shelf, and they had sat there probably since the 1940s. And they were more or less untouched. They had a bit of beer foam flecked on them, on the binding. Every now and then, someone would pull one out, usually to use to put up the bridge tally on, because in those days, everyone played bridge. You just pull some chairs together. And today, students play solitaire on their smartphones, but in those days, there was a social event called playing bridge. But they did play some symbolic role. They were a symbol that this was a university, and it was full of young people who were supposedly there to learn something, besides having a good time. And they played that role, and for all I know, they're still there. I haven't been in this building for probably 30 years, but I would not be surprised if they're still sitting on the shelf there. And I'm sure that's a phenomenon that was repeated in many other locales around the country. How this had come about really says a lot about American culture in the early 20th century. President Eliot was a chemist himself. He's the man who was president of Harvard for a very long time, and he's the one who turned a perfectly respectable New England college into a great worldwide, internationally known research institution. He's a very important figure in the history of American education. But he was also a very much a New Englander, with a famous New England last name. He thought he had a duty as a college president not only to run an institution and to raise the funds and all the things we expect of college presidents now, but he was a leader of the community, an intellectual and cultural and moral leader. And he was always looking for ways to manifest this. And one of these ways was to encourage the publication of this 5-foot shelf of books. There were 51 volumes. The first ones came out in 1909, and they literally filled the 5 feet that he described. And it was due not only to Eliot, but to a publisher, Collier & Sons. They had heard him give a speech in which he had said that if the average American intelligent working man sat down for 15 minutes every night and read the equivalent of the great books, in the course of 4 years, he would have had as good an education as anyone who went to Harvard. Now, this was a pretty wild boast, but people took it seriously, and certainly his publishing company took it seriously, very seriously. He enlisted the help of a man named William Neilson, who was an English professor who was later president of Smith College. And between the two of them, they decided what books would be included. They were forming a canon, and some of the titles were obvious, but some of them were a bit quirky. Eliot chose the books, Neilson wrote the notes, and then Eliot wrote a kind of introduction to the whole set. He started out with Ben Franklin's autobiography, his volume one, you know, that Bible of American self-improvement and how to get ahead in life. And that's kind of the tone of the five-foot shelf in a way. You really could improve yourself if you got through all these books. And he included a lot of scientists, interestingly enough, obviously Darwin, but also some scientists like Harvey, Jenner, Lister, Pasteur. He included some oddities like a whole volume of Robert Burns' poetry. I don't think we would think of that as one of the great books today. He included Plato, but did not include Aristotle. He included Richard Henry Dana, but no Herman Melville. And he certainly included no Marx, Nietzsche, Freud, all the people we would think of as the great minds of that period. So it was an odd, kind of quirky, very New England, very high-minded choice of books. And commercially, it was a huge success. It was so successful that a few years later, they added 20 volumes of fiction, running from Fielding through the great Russians. It was an enormous commercial success, as we can see in the fact that 350,000 sets were sold in the publishing lifetime of this quite substantial group of books. Even today, if you go on Amazon, you can get the set for about $300, $350. It works out a bit over $6 a book, perhaps, which is still a pretty good bargain. It is available online. It's completely archived, all the text. And it still pops up in various ways, not only in the secondhand shops or in the reminiscences of college students of that time, but also, for example, in a book that was published in 2009 by a young writer named Christopher Biha called The Whole 5 Feet. It was a book in which he described his year of reading his way through the Harvard classics, The Five-Foot Shelf. And at first when I heard this, I thought, oh, this is kind of a silly, it's one of these things publishers dream up to sell books. It's like, you know, I'm going to cook all the recipes in Julia Child's book in 1 year, or I'm going to bicycle to all the national parks in 1 year or whatever. One of these artificial deadlines and you know, a kind of silly stunt. But I read the book. It's a pretty quick read and very well written. And it turned out that although he started out someone in that spirit of just, you know, let's see if I can do it, it turned out that these books had a big impact on his life, and he was quite surprised by this. It turned out that that particular year was one of the worst years of his life. He had terrible health problems. He lost his job at age 30 or so. He had to move back in with his parents and was kind of humiliated by that. And a very beloved relative of his was dying of cancer that year, and he had to, had to deal with that and spend a lot of time with her. And what he found was, even though the books had no particular chronology or no particular thematic order, he read them just as they appeared in the 5 foot shelf in the original edition, they had enormous and unexpected impact on the way he dealt with the problems of his life. And he explains this, I'm not doing him justice, he explains this in great detail and very sympathetic detail, and it's a book you might want to look out for, The Whole 5 Feet. But he does make the case that these classics, as dusty as they might seem, and even in very old-fashioned translations, which I think all of us would have trouble reading today, they still had that kind of life-changing impact that really came to him as a complete surprise. You know, not every title, but an amazing number of them did. And so it's a wonderful example, I think, of how such texts can really work their way back out of off the library shelf and back into our lives. Now, this wasn't the only example of this kind of great books, commercial and intellectual enterprise. The University of Chicago in the 1950s came out with a series called Great Books of the Western World. You probably well remember that from school libraries or perhaps your own home. It, again, was an attempt to pick out the best in Matthew Arnold's famous phrase as to what a classic is, the best that has been thought and said in the history of the world. And it was done not by a Harvard professor, but by two men at the University of Chicago, Mortimer Adler and Robert Hutchins. And it is still in print. You see it here and there. It could be bought in the early days by mail. I went to high school in Florida, and I had a friend, Bob, who in 10th grade signed up for this subscription. And he was the son of the town's policeman, and, you know, grew up in a very modest family. But he had this impulse of self-improvement. He was kind of a tall, awkward, kind of spotty guy. And he had trouble getting women to pay attention to him, young women. And he figured out that if he showed up at school carrying one of the great books of the Western world under his arm, that at least caused some comment and, you know, curiosity. And so every month he sent in his $4.99 or whatever it was in those days in a box top. And the University of Chicago Press mailed him a volume of Aristotle or Aristophanes or who knows what, Aquinas and so forth down the line. And I have no idea if you ever read a single page of any of those books. But they played a role in his life. They were part of his self-presentation. And it worked in a funny way. It worked. Girls did talk to him. And then came the day when in the mail a plain brown wrapper arrived, and inside from the University of Chicago Press was the selected works of Sigmund Freud. And I guarantee you the conversation in the school lunchroom took a very different turn from that day on. We were absolutely thrilled to learn that we all had complexes, not to mention hidden desires and repressed feelings about our parents. And it was just a you know, a wonderfully intellectually stimulating moment in our, by that time it was 11th grade, I suppose. And again, I'm not sure any of us got through, all asking me if we could borrow the book, of course. I'm not sure any of us got all the way through Freud, but it was like a burst of lightning that just came through the air. And we could all thank the University of Chicago and Mortimer Adler for trying to bring this about. So I don't know what happened to Bob. I lost track with him for many, many years. And recently, my high school was planning a reunion, a 50th reunion, and so people are popping up on Facebook, people had names I'd totally forgotten. And just the other day, there was Bob, and he's in real estate now in Jacksonville, I think. And I was starting to think, is there anything Freudian about real estate? Well, erecting tall buildings? I don't know. It's but it all goes back to the great books of the Western world. There was even a college in 1937, St. John's College in Annapolis was established with the great books as its curriculum, and it's still flourishing. They even have a branch now in Santa Fe, where they also follow the curriculum. And then there have been all kinds of other publishing enterprises over the years and through the 20th century. Penguin Books, Penguin Classics, starting in England in 1935. They were sold sixpence each. They were designed so you'd have something to read on the train, but not just a piece of you know, detective fiction, but a solid classic from the great tradition. And they really caught on. You know, during World War II, there were special editions made for soldiers and POWs, and the Penguin Classics certainly were very much a part of, I think, all our lives when we were in college and beyond. Their version, for example, of the Odyssey, translated by an English scholar named Rieux, in 1946, it was published and has since sold 3 million copies. You know, not bad for Homer. And it's now part of Random House, but the classics are still being published on the Penguin imprint. In America, the Library of America that Edmund Wilson championed, and which finally came about as a reality in the 1980s, again, it's an attempt to put all of the classics into a uniform edition in a handy, permanent, acid-free format. And you can buy, you know, whole sets of these volumes that incorporate the great literary classics of the American tradition, mostly fiction and poetry, but some nonfiction, travel books, whatever, nature books, et cetera, et cetera. So we are all, to some degree, touched by this great tradition, but I'm not sure to what degree it really plays a big role in the lives of a lot of Americans anymore. In the age of social media, it's very hard to find time to read a long book, much less a difficult book. I don't mean to belittle social media. I think we all depend on it to one degree or another. Certainly Wikipedia has changed my life, and I'm sure you've been to dinner parties where some question has come up that in the old days would have sent you running to the encyclopedia, but someone now just pulls out their smartphone and gets the answer. So at that level, we're still dealing with some of the issues the great books as texts raise, but we don't maybe have a permanent habit of turning to them the way Christopher Behe did to help us get through difficult moments in life. And in a way, you know, that's inevitable. In another way, it's most unfortunate. It's a diminishment of what we're doing. There was an article very much to this point in this week's New York Times Book Review. It just came out yesterday. It's an article by a poet named David Lehman. It's an introduction to a volume of the Best American Poetry of 2014. But it's also a little essay he writes about the nature of classics and why they should still be important in our lives. And he says at one point, and he's quoting another writer, Russell Berman, he's saying that the ability of an educated populace to read critically, to write clearly, to think coherently, and to retain knowledge, even the ability to grasp the basic rules of grammar and diction, seems to be declining at a pace consonant with the rise of the internet search engine and the autocorrect function in computer programs. So what I'm trying to say today, I suppose, is that to save you from those autocorrect programs and all the other electronic intrusions in your own mental lives and social lives, too, there still is some role that great books can play, particularly through an event like Winter Weekend, which is not only an intellectual and cultural exercise, but a very pleasant social occasion, as I hope you, those of you who have been there will agree with me in saying. It's not based on any strict and rigid notion of there being a canon. You know, the word canon scares people, and it certainly, for the last 20, 30 years, it's been a dirty word in academic life. You know, it's something that's identified with dead European males. It's something oppressive, and I won't bore you with all the condemnation of the canon. But it's basically a religious concept. There was a canon that the church fathers decided of what books from Hebrew scripture, what books from the Christian writings would go into forming the Bible. And the word has been used ever since then to describe any list of kind of officially approved texts that everyone should know something about, at least, and preferably at some point read. But the Humanities Council has not taken the approach that there is a rigid canon of books that we all have to get through. I think there are probably books that we would all agree that people should read, and you know, the works of Shakespeare would be an obvious candidate there, but many of us would include Dante and Homer and on down the list. But what we've done in choosing books for Winter Weekend is to try to get a selection of books that really are big, that you can sink your teeth into through the cold winter months. This coming year, in March, we will be doing Faulkner's Absalom Absalom. Faulkner was a solid choice. A lot of people were very eager to tackle Absalom Absalom. I think because it deals with racial issues and the whole history of Mississippi and the Deep South, and you know that's still part of our everyday lives and in terms of the news we get and the politics we're involved in and the way we think about our country and our fellow countrymen. So at that level alone, it's a book worth reading. It really is a very deep and somewhat unsettling meditation on why we make race count, and why we treat it as such an important thing in the way we judge other people. But it seems to be something that holds our country in bad ways that we haven't been able to shake off despite a civil war and the civil rights movement. So Faulkner, in that sense, is a wonderfully timely choice. Some of the other books have been very timely, too. For example, the Russian novels. We've read War and Peace, Anna Karenina, and most recently, Crime and Punishment. And you know, when you read Dostoevsky, or read the story of Dostoevsky's life, all you can think of is Putin, Putin, Putin. I mean, they are so much of Putin's mindset ties in with Dostoevsky's Russian nationalism and his Slavophilia and his intense interest in the Russian Orthodox Church and the notion that the Russian way of doing things, although it may be materially backward, it's somehow spiritually superior to the way that we do things in the West. So, you know, anything by Dostoevsky is very much of the moment. And with Tolstoy, the connection would be not only that, you know, we're always in a war somewhere or another, but Tolstoy's own career began in the Crimea. His Sevastopol sketches were journalistic accounts of the Crimean War in the 1850s. And the Crimea is certainly a place we've seen on the map in the last few months. But what I wanted to conclude with is an example that came up in New York City quite recently. And it involves the much contested, much disputed memorial site for the 9/11 tragedy. And if you followed that building project over the last 10 years, you know, it has been filled with every kind of disagreement. What kind of memorial was this going to be? Were we supposed to rebuild the towers? Were we supposed to create a kind of national cemetery there, some kind of very spiritual sanctuary or pilgrimage spot? Was it supposed to be a museum that would tell the story of the place quite objectively, including trying to explain the origins of Islamic fundamentalism and Islamic jihadism. Was it going to be a place that would be open to the general public as a park where you could go and have a sandwich and sit and play with your children and walk your dog? Or was it to be something that was going to be set apart from the city where you approached in a very reverent and important ritual site that had to be treated in a very solemn manner? So these controversies have been in the press and in the news for 10 years now, and they're still not totally solved, although a lot of, as you know, a lot of the memorial has been built, including the wonderful fountains that instead of going up, go down. And they're incredibly impressive. And then the names of all the people who died in bronze are on the edge. So what they have come up with is an enormously moving piece of urban commemoration. But in the course of building this museum in this area to hold the unidentified remains, they commissioned one artist in the whole project. He's the only artist, I think, who's had an independent commission. And he's a man named Spencer Finch. And what he does is work with pieces of colored paper, about the size of typing paper. Do you remember typing paper? Am I dating myself? 8x11 or 11.5. And he colors them, and then he makes these mosaic-like murals with these hanging papers. And they're not pasted on. They're kind of hung on wires that you don't see, so that when you walk by or when the breeze blows, they ripple a little bit. So they wanted to take this one step further and not just have this beautiful, expansive color. They wanted some phrase to go on it. We all, I think, in commemorating someone or something, we always are looking for some lapidary phrase that will just sum it or inspire us when we visit the site. And they came up with a quote from Virgil, from the Aeneid, from the ninth book of the Aeneid. And the quote reads, "No day shall erase you from the memory of time." Now, I don't know how recently you've read the Aeneid, and I don't know if that quote jumped out at you. The theory is someone in the architectural offices found it in Bartlett's or some other quotation book. Our degree of classical education is such, it probably didn't just pop into their minds. But they went ahead with it, and it's a lovely quote. It's very expressive, and it's in some ways just perfect for what they were trying to do. "No day shall erase you from the memory of time." Well, this was announced to the public, and you know, most people, if they thought about it at all, thought, well, that's nice. Who's Virgil? Maybe they got their smartphones and did Wikipedia and found who Virgil was. Maybe not. But the classicists, and there are still some classicists in the world, a handful perhaps, but some well-placed ones, they knew the origin of the quotation, and they began to protest because it comes from a very odd episode in the Aeneid, and it, as a result of that, it is a very odd choice for this memorial, some people argue. In Book 9, there's an incident in which two young Trojans... Just to jump back a second, the Aeneid is a story of the founding of Rome by a Trojan prince who escapes with his father and his son and the city's protected deities, the statues of the goddesses and whatever. He flees from the ruins of Troy after the Greeks have come in with their famous horse and are laying the city to ruin, pillaging and plundering and raping and whatever. Aeneas and his small group, he's joined by a few other Trojans, they travel around the Mediterranean. They end up in what is now Libya, the city of Carthage, and they decide, well, this is where we're going to stay because it's such a lovely city and there are all these lovely women, and the Trojan men match up the women. And Aeneas himself, of course, falls in love with the famous queen of Carthage, Dido. And there are wonderful descriptions in literature and painting and in a couple of operas. Purcell and Berlioz, to name two of the best-known composers of those operas. They're wonderful tales of the whole episode of Dido and Aeneas. But the gods are hard to please, and there are a couple of gods in particular, a goddess in particular, who has quite a lot of anger towards Aeneas. And she makes him leave Carthage, and Dido is crushed, and she throws herself on the funeral pyre and perishes. And so that's the first half of the Aeneid, and it's the half most people read, or at least have heard about, or seen illustrated in some fashion. The other half of the Aeneid, the other six books, tells the story of when the Trojans reach the Italian peninsula and their very delayed and much contested progress up to the Tiber, where they will eventually establish Rome. And they have to fight certain number of tribes that are already there, and they form allies with other tribes, and they intermarry with some of the tribes in the course of their push up the peninsula. And this episode in Book 9 tells of two young Trojans who are part of this military campaign to establish Rome, and who decide one night, well, we're going to do something, you know, we want to get in the history books, the epics, the way that Achilles does, the way Odysseus does. So we're going to do something really heroic. We're going to sneak out of the camp at night, cross over the river, and go into the camp of the enemy. I think the Rutulian tribe, who were the enemy at that point. And we're going to kill some of them and then grab some booty, some nice armor or whatever, or some wine and what have you. And we're going to get back before light. We'll do this undercover of darkness. And we will be the talk of the Trojan army. People will be so amazed by this exploit. And so they do it. They sneak across the river and into the camp of the sleeping enemy. They kill a lot of the Rutulians in their sleep, and they take the booty and are about to get away when some other tribal group or some other part of the Rutulian army discovers them and challenges them, and they get in a big fight. And one of them, named Nisus, the older of the two young men, manages almost to get back to the Trojan camp across the river. But then he notices that his friend Euryalus is in deep trouble, and he knows he should escape, but he is so devoted to his friend, he goes back and tries to save him. And in the process, they're both killed, and their heads are cut off and put on pikes and paraded around the next day so the Trojans will see them. So in Virgil's beautiful poetry, this is a wonderful instant, and the language is just fabulous, and I mean, it even comes through in translation, I think, pretty well. The Robert Fitzgerald passage from which this comes is really a very wonderfully written piece of English translated from the Latin. But the trouble with this story, and this line, is something the narrator of the poem says to the, as it were, to the spirit, the shades of Nisus and Euryalus. We shall remember you, meaning the two young men, forever. Your memory will not be erased from the annals of time, the memory of time. The problem is, well, there's several, I wouldn't say they're problems, there's several complications to this story, and the classicists were very fast to point this out. One is that Nisus and Euryalus were not just comrades, they weren't just sharing a tent, they were lovers, in the kind of classical sense of the word. They were the Trojan equivalent of a gay marriage, and the fact that Nisus goes back to save his friend, it's more than just a military decision or an act of bravado or heroism. You know, it's something, there's an emotional element there that maybe would not be immediately obvious to a modern reader. The other thing is, what they did was a kind of terrorist act. I mean, they went and killed people in their sleep. Nothing very heroic about that. And it, in a lot of ways, it was just a stupid prank that went wrong. There was nothing very heroic about it, that if you look at it in those lights. And so if you have a story like that and you're pulling a quote from it, what obligation do you have to explain to people the context? And can you assume people will know the context already? No, unless you're a classics major or particularly a close reader of the Aeneid. So on the other hand, some people, after they thought about it a little while, said, well, you know, it is an act of heroism, that act of friendship, of going back and saving people, because that happened in 9/11. First responders went in and risked their lives, sometimes lost their lives, to rescue someone. You know, there was that element that something was going on that's parallel to what Virgil was talking about. And other people said, well, you know, the quote is so innocuous in one sense and so perfect in another for the situation. What difference does it make, the context that it originally appeared in? You know, very few people read the poem anymore. Let's just move on and, you know, not make a fuss about it. So that's where it stands now. It's still there. I think it will stay there. Virgil's name is still at the bottom, but they took the reference to Book 9 of the Aeneid off, as if kind of, you know, rubbing out the... You know, we don't want our children looking that up. So I choose it. You know, it was a very tiny incident from the huge controversy and the huge amount of planning and commentary that has gone into this memorial. But it struck me as, you know, the classics are still alive, at least in certain funny ways and unexpected ways. And it really, you know, it adds something to your understanding of the 9/11 commemoration effort, if you know the story of Virgil and his Nisus and Euryalus, you know, there was a time, not within living memory, when there have been a lot of people out there who would have read and have internalized Virgil and Homer and Dante and all the others, and who would have picked up on something like that maybe pretty quickly, at least, especially if you told them where that quote came from, what book of the Aeneid. But such people are fewer and fewer. And I don't think we're living in a culture where there's going to be a resurge of that type of education, that type of mentality. So maybe Bartlett's is the most we can hope for, and even that's better than some things I could think of. But I came across a quote the other day, I forget the exact source, but it was some man whose grandfather had memorized lots of Longfellow, of all things. And his grandson, who was a writer, was thinking about that. Well, what did that mean to my grandfather that he held this poetry in his head? And so at the very least, it meant he knew a lot of words. I mean, he had a huge vocabulary. And he had some sense, maybe from the poetry. You know, it's very traditional poetry in terms of meter, certainly. But he had some sense of the rhythms of language and how words fit together. And it's something that probably enriched his life in many, many ways, and certainly his verbal abilities, that side of his life. And this young writer said, you know, well, what have I memorized? I've memorized a lot of lines from the movie Caddyshack. and I remember them all, and I use them. But what's the difference in the verbal power that my grandfather had with all this poetry in his head, and the rather starved language that I'm speaking and writing because I have so much of Caddyshack in my head? So, again, it's something that not many people are going to bother with, but those who do bother with it, I think, are rewarded at many, many levels, and not only at the immediate moment when they're enjoying the reception and the dinner at Winter Weekend, but a year, 2 years, 5 years later when things click, you see the reference and it all falls in place. So there are many good reasons to attend Winter Weekend and the Council's other programs, but I would say this kind of thing is very gratifying when you can put it all together and realize how lasting this story, how this story is endured and is still being, at some level, told and thought about and argued about. Someone asked the other day, you know, what we use this word classic all the time, and you know, what do you mean by classic, and what's the definition? And my quick definition was, it's a book you feel guilty for not having read. But maybe a classic is a book that has that kind of, you know, not only enduring power or iconic power in the culture, but has many levels of complexity, and you never really get to the bottom of it. You can read some stories, and you've got them down flat, and you know, you move on. But the classics are the books you keep coming back to because they raise exactly that kind of ambiguity and difficulty and uncertainty about what the text means. Well, I'm keeping you from the lemonade and cookies, but you've been a wonderful audience. Thank you very much.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and from friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.